Did you know that Ethiopia is one of the leading destinations for Bitcoin mining in the world? I didn't. Here's the reason why.
The price of electricity in Ethiopia is about 3.2 cents kilowatt hour, which is much cheaper than many other places of the world. Additionally, more than 92% of our energy comes from hydroelectricity. I'm using the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam.
More on that in a moment. And we'll hear from two leading voices in Nigeria's football scene on how sports can help with the climate crisis. Hello, I'm Charles Gitonga, and we'll be discussing these two subjects along with one of the bigger stories on the African continent this week. It's Friday, the 22nd of November. So first, let's go to Mali. Mali's military leader this week sacked the Prime Minister, Chuguel Kokala Maiga, and his government. It came after rare criticism by Maiga of the junta's lack of clarity about a once-promised return to democracy. Maiga, who was appointed by the military 2 years ago, accused the junta of postponing the elections without informing him and said confusion around an end to the transition could pose serious challenges and the risk of going backwards. He said this to his supporters at a rally last Saturday. In response to Maiga's statement, the junta organized demonstrations against him. Now, Mali, you will remember, has been ruled by military leaders since the junta seized power in 2020 and staged another coup the following year. In June 2022, the junta promised a return to civilian rule by March 2024, but later postponed elections. No date has been set yet for the presidential election. General Abdoulaye Maiga has been named as the country's new prime minister. This is the moment they announced the new prime minister.
Article 1, General Abdoulaye Maiga is appointed prime minister. Article 2, this decree will be registered and published officially. Bamako, 21st of November, 2024. The President of the Transition, Head of State, signed, General Assimi Goïta.
I've been speaking to Sahel analyst Bram Posthumus, who began by telling me more about the now-sacked Prime Minister.
Prime Minister Chuguel Kokala Maiga, as is his full name, as we now know, was fired after he had made comments about the length of the transition back to civilian or constitutional rule in Mali. He was unhappy with the fact that the junta of now general, if memory serves, Assimi Goïta, didn't keep to its own timetable. And the junta is not very prone to accepting criticism from anybody. And so Maiga found himself out. This is not surprising, actually, because Maiga was gradually being excluded from all kinds of key decision making, which is done by the junta. There's no question about who is in charge here. These are the military. They are in charge. And so there was already maneuvering going on to get him out. But then this obviously was quite possibly, from the junta's point of view, the most perfect occasion to get rid of him. And that's exactly what they did.
So briefly, who was he? And does anything about him tell us about this disagreement with the junta?
Chuguel Maiga has a long history in politics in Mali, goes all the way back to the second ruler of Mali, was a military man as well, by the name of Moussa Traoré. He was very close to Moussa Traoré in the 1980s, and then very quickly switched to being a Democrat when the street protests in 1991 removed Moussa Traoré from power. Then in the next two or three decades, he dabbled in and out of various governments. He was a minister. He was heading the telephone controlling agency. This man is a Soviet-trained telephone engineer, speaks fluent Russian, which was also useful for the people in power at this point. And I would say that the baseline that informs most of his actions is opportunity, is opportunism. Once he feels that the winds are changing, he changes tack. And I think there might even be a sense that Maiga feels that this junta may be running towards its end, and then a whole new dispensation emerges in which he might even be trying to run for the presidency. Underlining all this is his long view, and that is very, very clearly what's in it for me.
And now we do have a new prime minister, General Abdoulaye Maiga. That was quite quick, a change that happened within 24 hours of sacking of the previous prime minister. What do we know about this new prime minister?
Oh, he was waiting in the wings. He's been already an interim prime minister when Kokkola Maiga was ill. That what happened in 2020, 2021, if memory serves. And then he took over. He is mainly known to be the spokesperson of the military junta in Bamako and a loyal adherent to that particular group of people. He can tell the story that the junta wants to put out very well, and that's his function. And he will be in that function as long as he's prime minister as well, because, you know, prime ministers in this particular dispensation in Mali do not really have that much influence and power. They're useful to have on board because it is sort of like a link with the population at large. But at the end of the day, it's the junta that decides everything. And whoever happens to be in the post of prime minister is by and large immaterial.
So we had a quick removal and a quick installation. How is this likely to play out?
All the indications are that the junta is in it for the long haul. They have been talking about the transition. They've even managed to make sure that $80 million equivalent is put in the 2025 budget to finance elections. These elections will not take place. Nothing of the sort is going to happen. The colonels or generals who are now in power under Assimi Goïta, who's the absolute man in charge, are in it for the long haul, as I said, and they are not going to relinquish power, and certainly not voluntarily. So any talk of a timetable or any talk of an end to the transition, as ex-Prime Minister Maiga was alluding to, is basically fruitless, because there will be no elections. They will always have the insecurity situation in Mali as an excuse to say, no, we must hold on to power because this situation hasn't been resolved. The whole purpose for the junta to be there, and the whole purpose for instance, their endless repression of people who disagree with them, be they politicians, be they former ministers, be they journalists or other personalities, all of that serves only one purpose, and that's to maintain the junta in power. And the same goes for the other countries in the alliance, you know, Burkina Faso and Niger. The sole purpose why they are there is to maintain themselves in power. Power maintenance is the name of the game.
And now we are having all these key changes in government without any elections, really. But for the sake of context, just remind us how many times an election has been postponed since the military took power in 2020 in Mali.
Well, first of all, there was an agreement with the West African body ECOWAS, and I think the timetable then stipulated something like 24 months. Obviously, that timetable elapsed, and then there was another timetable, and then the main timetable, which is what caused this friction with the ex-Prime Minister Maiga, was the end of the year. I mean, that was, I think, the thing that they were talking about. Even the fact that 2025 was supposed to be an election which had already been budgeted for, I mean, that would strongly suggest that there was talk of the elections taking place in 2025. The problem is that the junta has always been ambiguous about whether or not this would take place. It's both the constant moval of the goalposts, if you like, when it comes to, okay, what does your timetable actually look like? Plus the fact that there is a very deliberate and studied ambiguity on the part of the junta about whether or not this transition will finally end. And that gets the activists and the politicians and the media exactly where the military wants them, in a place of uncertainty, so they can stay in power, which is, again, I keep coming back to this point, but that's the purpose of them being there.
But in terms of then life in Mali, how is it like with military, you know, power leading the country?
I think the military power in and of itself manifests itself in human rights abuses across the country, which is not something that's really attached to whether or not the military are in power. The army has a history of misbehaving, although misbehaving even worse when there is a military junta in power, because the checks and balances are completely missing, whereas normally, in inverted commas, the checks and balances are deficient. But on the whole, I mean, I'm getting very frequent distress calls from friends in Mali saying that the situation is going from bad to worse. Financially, economically, people find it increasingly difficult to make ends meet because of the fact that the economy is malfunctioning. The only thing that really works at this point is gold mining. And as we know, and this is an indication of how desperate even the military junta members are for money, they have been extorting money from various mining houses by taking executives and personnel hostage. There are two examples of this in the past month, and more to follow, because the junta can't pay its bills. And this is a pretty bad situation to be in, especially if you are also dealing with mounting insecurity. The September attack on the police school, the National Gendarmerie School in Bamako, was the first attack against the capital city of Mali in years. And that also gives you some idea of how bad the situation actually is. And we are looking at self-styled jihadist groups that are gradually encircling Bamako. And this is very dangerous, because obviously that is the one entry and exit point for the country when it comes to international finance, international investment, and all the rest of it, and even aid, the little that still comes in. Once people get wind of the fact that Mali is increasingly insecure, in spite of what the military junta tells you, then the economic situation can only get worse.
Yeah, what do these changes then say about, the stability of the country, given what you've said? I mean, we've been reporting about all these attacks and the state of insecurity in Mali, but then you have quickly changing events sometimes at the very top of the leadership of the country. How does that speak to the stability of the whole thing?
Well, it speaks of a great instability in the country, and it also speaks of the fact that as far as the self-styled jihadist movements are concerned, whoever happens to be running the government in Bamako is of very little relevance to them. They are gradually, slowly but surely, increasing their writ on the country, and they don't need to physically be there. What they need to do is to create insecurity, to create a situation of insecurity by doing hit-and-run attacks, by attacking army installations, border posts, customs posts, all these kind of uniformed personnel, places where uniformed personnel gathers to, you know, check traffic and all that sort of thing. And these are the targets that they are selecting in order to create among the population at large a feeling of insecurity. And so far, they are succeeding in increasing measure, because it's no longer just the north. It's no longer just the center of Mali. That's unstable. It's pretty much everywhere.
Bram Postuma's there. Next, let's talk about Bitcoin, which is a huge talking point in the news again. To kick things off, here is an explanation of what it is and how it works from my colleague Nyasha Michelle.
Bitcoin is the most well-known cryptocurrency, which is a form of digital money. Unlike the physical notes in your wallet, Bitcoin exists virtually in the digital space and can be used to buy things online. Some physical shops also accept payment in Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. So, how does it work? Well, it should be as simple as sending an email to your friend or colleague. Unlike usual money, Bitcoin is not regulated by a central bank, so it bypasses middlemen and goes directly to the recipient. And this leads us to talking about the system through which all this happens, and it's called blockchain. It's a global network of volunteers, typically computers, which verify transactions. And once the transaction is verified, it is added to a block. And once the block is full, another one forms. Hence the name blockchain. The process of verifying these transactions earns the owners of the computers a payment in form of Bitcoin. And this is called mining, and is how new Bitcoin is created.
Thanks to Nyasha. So the reason we are looking into the cryptocurrency is not because the industry's biggest critic, Gary Gensler, said he will stand down as the head of the US Securities Exchange Commission, but because Ethiopia is now emerging as a hub for Bitcoin mining in Africa. Did you know that? According to statistics, Addis Ababa ranks fourth globally on the list of destinations most preferred by mining companies. Why? Well, it has something to do with electricity. Carl Kasa is an advisor and educator at Bitcoin Bear in Addis Ababa.
Bitcoin mining works by an algorithm called SHA-256. SHA standing for Secure Hash Algorithm, and 256 meaning 256 bit. And it requires a hardware that's specially made. They're called ASICs chips, application-specific integrated circuits. And through this permissionless network. Permissionless meaning anyone can provide energy, electricity into the network and receive a reward. And so every 10 minutes, these rewards are given out to the Bitcoin miners, depending on how much energy they've contributed into the Bitcoin network.
Paint for me a picture then. How does a Bitcoin farm look like? If I walked in, what would I see?
Sure. So the average facility in Ethiopia is about 5,000 square meters and consists of roughly 10,000 machines. And these machines are connected to power distribution units, which are then connected.
Are these like computers or what kind of machines are they?
Correct. They are computers, but they only serve one purpose. So you can't the next day process data and AI and, you know, hook it up to a monitor and use it to run Windows and Apple. These computers are application specific and they only do one thing, and that's compute Bitcoin and earn a reward. And so these facilities are massive factories. They're very noisy because all of these computers have fans. So there's a buzzing sound. And with about 10,000 machines, they're using roughly 30 megawatts of power, which is very significant.
Right. And are there people that work in these mining facilities, or is it just thousands of computers doing their things?
Well, it's definitely more computers than people. It might require a few dozen technical electrical engineers, computer engineers, perhaps somebody with a bachelor's that understands not only Bitcoin mining and the hardware, but also the electricity, the substation, power distribution, and the rest.
So tell us then why Ethiopia is becoming a favorite destination for this activity of Bitcoin mining.
Excellent question. It's a question I get asked quite often. And really the answer is the price of energy, electricity in Ethiopia is about 3.2 cents kilowatt hour, which is much cheaper than many other places of the world. Additionally, in Ethiopia, more than 92% of our energy comes from renewable resources, hydroelectricity, using the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, which is a $6 billion project that will generate 6 gigawatts of energy using the Nile River. So that's the reason why these miners are coming into Ethiopia. They have competitively priced power.
So previously, where would they do this activity of Bitcoin mining? And is it to mean that, you know, electricity has become a bit more expensive elsewhere, and so the price in Ethiopia is a bit more favorable?
It does. It does. So you have right now Ethiopia commanding about 5% of the global hash rate. So we're still have a small market share compared to many other countries. If you look at markets like Texas and the United States, they have many Bitcoin miners coming in because of their energy market, ERCOT. Previously, we've had countries like Venezuela and Kazakhstan attempt Bitcoin mining. And then you have countries like Russia and China that are also significantly contributing to the Bitcoin global hash rate. So this is where the miners are coming from: the United States, Russia, and China.
And the hash rate being?
The amount of electricity, let's call it compute power, that is mining Bitcoin.
I see. So who are these companies then that are coming to Ethiopia to do this?
So the vast majority of these companies, right now there are 20 registered in Ethiopia. About 11 of them are operational. I would say about 80% of the Bitcoin miners in Ethiopia are from China, and then the rest being from Russia as well as the United States.
Right. You know, I did read that actually you are not allowed to trade in cryptocurrency in Ethiopia, which I found very odd, seeing as the country is quite capitalizing on mining of the same.
Yes, it is a bit odd, but we're still opening up our capital markets. We've recently introduced legislation that will open up our capital controls, allow dollars and foreign banks to operate here. And so what I think will happen is, as these international banks come into Ethiopia, this practice of owning crypto and using it as a medium of exchange for daily purchases may get adopted as the market opens up.
So how is this then benefiting the country?
The first and major benefit for Ethiopia is in the sale of electricity to the miners. So right now, the state-owned enterprise, or Ethiopian Electric Power, EEP, has generated $55 million over the past year from Bitcoin miners. And over the next year, they forecast that they will earn $123 million in 1 year. And so this is significant revenue for Ethiopia. And so if we're able to use this in the right fashion and help the utility develop its network, its grid, then we can provide electricity to 50% of Ethiopians that currently don't have access to electricity. So that's how it benefits Ethiopia.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because I was just thinking, when, you know, you walk in the streets of Addis Ababa, people that might know what you do and how much electricity the government has to sell to companies that mine Bitcoin, I was wondering how they might feel, because a lot of people in Ethiopia still do not have electricity, but then you have a lot of it being sold to Bitcoin mining companies. What do you think?
Absolutely. And I think this is why education is very important in this industry, because the public needs to understand that the Bitcoin miners aren't competing against residential, retail, industrial, and commercial centers. They are actually supporting the development of the grid by providing revenue that otherwise would not be there. The thing about electricity is, if you don't store it in a battery, it dissipates. It makes economic sense to have the miners there next to you, supporting the substation and generating revenue that otherwise would be lost.
And again, I mean, I'm sure you've heard, and you would have probably participated in conversations of just the environmental footprint of cryptocurrencies. How would you make the case of how to make these currencies while, you know, not having a lot of footprint on the environment?
Sure. Well, I think renewable sources are a good start. And Ethiopia being the home to the Nile River, it creates a great deal of hydroelectric energy. There may be other initiatives. There might be other activities that miners and power producers can do to be more sustainable and eco-friendly. But as of now, there's no better place in the world to mine Bitcoin than Ethiopia.
All right. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you, Charles.
Carl Kasa, an advisor and educator at Bitcoin Bear in Addis Ababa. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. As the UN Climate Change Conference, COP29, heads to its final day in Baku, we wanted to talk about how sports can also play a part in helping with the climate crisis. It's part of a UN initiative called Sports for Climate Action, which aims at supporting and guiding those in the field of sport to achieve global climate change goals. Two leading voices in the Nigerian football have been talking about how this can make a difference. They are the captain of Nigeria's men's team, William Troost Ekong, who has long been an advocate for sustainability, and former Nigeria international Ayisat Yusuf, who has voiced her concerns about some of the sponsorship deals that football's world body, FIFA, has taken on. Both Troost Ekong and Yusuf have welcomed the push for change at COP29. I've been speaking to BBC Sports Isaiah Akinremi in Lagos. Let's listen. Isaiah, as COP29 draws to a close this week, will sports organizations be looking more closely at their responsibilities when it comes to climate change?
Very much so, Charles. If we think back to 2018, it was at COP24 in Katowice in southern Poland when the Sport for Climate Action Framework was launched. It's an initiative which aims to support and guide sport bodies towards achieving their climate change goals through their commitment and partnership. So earlier this year, there was a big announcement, you know, from FIFA about a major sponsorship deal with oil giant Aramco. Not only were, you know, their concerns from a number of current and former women's footballers globally about FIFA partnering up with a Saudi company because of human rights issues, but also they were worried about the environment as well. And from what we gathered about Aramco, the independent think tank Carbon Tracker claimed Aramco is the world's largest corporate greenhouse gas emitter. And as such, this drops some reactions from some professional women footballers, 106 of them, who are, women's players and ex-players, who wrote an open letter to FIFA calling on football's governing body to reconsider the partnership. And it was the former Nigerian international, Aisat Yusuf, who we spoke to. She's the only African signatory in the letter. And she told me why this is so important to her.
When we talk about climate change, it affects most people that do sport, because we all know that football is one of the biggest events that bring people together. So the letter was very, very, very much important for me, because it's a collective effort. No organization should be bigger than FIFA. Even if money is involved, they don't have to jeopardize or take money above humanity. I mean, by prioritizing money over humanity and try to step on our human rights. So I think it's very much important that we just let FIFA know that partnership or giving sponsorship to Aramco as part of football governing does not stand for what our value is.
Yusuf had 68 caps for the Super Falcons of Nigeria. They're saying FIFA should not choose money over humanity. But Charles, in response, FIFA told us it values its partnership with Aramco and its commercial partners, and that revenues generated are reinvested back into the game at all levels, and investment in women's football continues to increase. As for Aramco, on the other side, they state on their website that environmental stewardship is deeply integral to their approach.
And Isaiah, you've also been speaking to the captain of Nigeria's men's team, William Troost Ekong, and he's advocated for more individual responsibility from sportsmen and women when it comes to protecting the environment. Tell us about it.
Troost Ekong is the skipper of the Super Eagles. We met him in Huyo, where the Super Eagles play, their home games. And right now, Ekong plays his football with Saudi Pro League side Al Khulod. Well, let me just tell you about Ekong. He's an ambassador and investor with the sustainable football boot company Sokito, one of a few companies who offer recycled boots. Well, at the African Cup of Nations earlier this year in Ivory Coast, Troost Ekong was named the most valuable player, and he made the headline not just leading Nigeria to the final, but something, historic happened there, Charles, at the Nations Cup. Troost Ekong became the first player in an international tournament to wear boots made from recycled materials. That looks, fancy enough. But let me just describe how this boot, looks like. The boot is made from corn waste. The sole plate is from castor beans. And the insole is made from sugarcane and bamboo. And that makes the old boot recyclable. And for Ekong, he told me his passion for sustainability and climate change came with being a father.
It's just the awareness that I got over the last three years. I've got three young children myself. I'd like to think that they can enjoy the same things that we get to enjoy in our generation. And I think we have to be mindful of the changes that are happening and making the positive changes ourselves to really make a difference.
That's William Troost Ekong, the Nigerian captain there. Isaiah, tell me if other African sports stars have also spoken about climate change in recent months.
Definitely, Charles. African superstars, have been in the forefront of championing issues when it comes to climate change. But the most high profile of them is Kenyan marathon superstar Eliud Kipchoge, who has spoken passionately about doing more to combat air pollution. Kipchoge says planting trees helps conserve the planet, and that's another measure which Troost Ekong also supports. Some good move by Troost Ekong, because he completed the first international carbon neutral transfer when he moved from Watford to Italy's Salernitana in January 2023 by planting trees to offset his total carbon footprint. So, Charles, interestingly, in the world of football this week, maybe some good news for Arsenal fans, because Arsenal announced their commitment to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 97% in 2040. And Arsenal is the only football club in the world to have a net zero target approved by the science-based target initiative. So off the pitch, maybe some, you know, welcoming news for Arsenal fans. And Trostekong told me that when the focus is on events such as COP29, the whole world of sport should take notice.
I think sports is such a big influence around the world. I mean, it's not just only about the players. We have to go higher up when we talk about the organisers of the big tournaments, organisers of the big competitions, the clubs, the owners of football teams, and of course the fans, because those are the biggest numbers. Those are who we want to see, the people that want to get involved with it. So I think there should be different ways that we can incentivise that and encourage people, and also just to educate people through football when we have the chance.
Is there, in terms of climate change, has the sport been affected because of environmental issues, and especially in Africa?
Yes, Charles. Last year, African sport was impacted negatively when it comes to environmental issues. And it happened in Libya, where the devastating floods, you know, in Libya claimed the lives of a number of elite footballers in the city of Derna. And just in the past couple of weeks, global sports events have been impacted also. It will interest you to note that the start of tennis Billie Jean King Cup in Malaga had to be pushed back because of heavy rain in Spain. So Aissat Yusuf, you know, says sporting bodies have a responsibility to make better choices when it comes to climate change.
Sport leaders are very, very much important. They should get more involved from the local club, from the FAs, organizations, countries, and all of that. If you don't try to tackle this, it's going to cause even more hazard. So it's a collective effort fighting for a common goal. They should please give us a listening here and make the world a safer and better place for everyone by tackling this climate change for the betterment of everyone.
That's former Nigeria international Aissat Yusuf there. And our thanks to the BBC's Isaiah Akinremi in Lagos. Focus on Africa was put together by Yvette Togira Maria, Nishat Lather, and Nyasha Michelle in London. Kani Sharp was a senior journalist in charge of the program, and Jack Graysmark was a technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Muthengi are our editors. A reminder that you can now find us on YouTube. I'm Charles Gitonga. We'll talk again next time.